Chris Assembly, so at UTS.
Thanks very much. It's been quite nice listening to what Ron and Jock had to say, because a number of points I'll be talking about later are better clarified in the context of what we've been told already. It's interesting. Let me just start off with my basic slide, and we can perhaps take it from there. But before I do so, I would like to make the obvious point that when it comes to issues of immigration and race, it doesn't matter which country we talk about. It's always an emotional issue. The question is whether we can divorce ourselves from the emotional element and actually come to terms with what the realities and, of course, the myths may be. And the truth is, there's always a myth somewhere. Of course, there is a reality somewhere. What I intend to do today is to look at some of these myths and perhaps touch on some of the realities too. I begin with what perhaps triggered my interest in this area to begin with, because my background, actually, I'm an international lawyer. I do a bit of torts and so on every now and again, but my main area is, of course, in human rights, refugee issues, and, of course, humanitarian immigration matters. And so about 4 or 5 years ago, I was, of course, intrigued with this, and most of you would have seen this, of course, in the newspapers. I'm particularly interested in this part, where Andrew Fraser, who was at the time a lecturer at a professor of law at Macquarie University, said that experience, practically everywhere in the world, tells us that an expanding black population is a surefire recipe for increases in crime, violence in the world, and a wide range of other social problems. Now, this is important. Actually, Andrew said a lot more than that. But for the purpose of today, we don't have to go there. We can, if you like, dismiss those elements with the contempt it deserves. I'm not here for that.
Can you just make a quick so we can get out on both screens?
Yeah. I'm a bit technologically challenged, but I think I'll try.
Can you, you want me to do it? Okay.
Please.
Okay. Okay, we got it?
So the point I was making was that this is an interesting statement at the time. This was about, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. It created a lot of, you know, media attention. But the point I'm making is that there were a lot of other points he also made. And quite frankly, as I said, we can dismiss all those parts he made. It's not very important for my purposes. Now, but as an African, there was an element of this story which also interested me. And particularly, given my interest in refugee law and humanitarian issues, this was a fascinating point. I was interested in this part. Is it possible that perhaps the increasing number of African immigrants may be leading to an increase in crime? The truth is, I can afford not to be politically correct on the matter, being black. Because for those who are not black, and of course, if you come with the usual baggage, with it, racial baggage, it's a bit difficult to discuss it. Given my connections in the African community, I was interested in this, and of course, I spoke to a number of Africans and raised the point that, don't you want to know? What if an increasing number of immigrants may, in fact, be causing this trouble? Surely, we have nothing to lose. Because if you take a look at it, if we investigate it, and there's a problem, let's fix it. If we investigate it and there's no problem, we are in business. You can go public, you can make as much noise as you like. This, as I said, was in 2005. The difficulty with it is that the African community itself is not properly organized, in my opinion. Because at the time when the statement came on, everyone took it up as a racial issue. And as I said, yes, of course, there is a racial angle to it, but you can dismiss that part. There is a much more fundamental policy issue involved here. But that matter wasn't properly taken up on. And maybe people like me are to blame too. Because, you see, with time, I think about a year and a half later, unfortunately, against a background of persistent negative media reports. Of course, Kevin Andrews then announced that, well, Australia will, from now onwards, reduce the number of intakes of Sudanese African refugees. The reason why I think it was a mistake, not just on Kevin Andrews' part, but indeed on the African community's part, is that it could have been better organized. It could have actually taken up the issue, not just as a race issue, but as a proper policy issue, by looking at the facts and figures, and then taking it up properly with the government to say that this is a mess. But that was never done. So by going on the race issue, of course, you then overlook the critical part, which allows the politician, well, for obvious reasons, wanting the vote, to go on the political path. So it was that Kevin Andrews announced it. But, as I said, we can strip the statement of all the usual racial elements and just go down to the basics. Surely, we all want to know. So let's look at some of the facts, and then we can discuss it. I'll begin with a basic point. Take a look at this graph here. And I call it a fact, because that's the case anyway. Now, this is, of course, the settler arrivals by region, 2008-2009. I'm not going back in time because it's not particularly important. What's interesting for us, though, is that, now, here is where we have African settler intake, about 13,000 for that period. Now, it's not exactly the leading figure here, because it comes well after the Kiwis anyway. Of course, here we have the Europeans, here we have other groups and so on. So Africa comes about sixth in line, so it's not a big deal. But here we're talking about the settler intake, the totality of intake, the totality of settler immigration to this country. So let's just go down a bit more and see where we get. You see, in any discussion on immigration issues, particularly where the debate is actually centered, we should be more interested in what one may call the offshore humanitarian aid. The reason being that that's where Australia, out of its generosity, goes out there and say, listen, as a member of the international community, we actually owe it to the world to contribute to, settling people who may have been having problems on humanitarian grounds, we think of it. But this is an important issue, because I've highlighted this area here. You will see that Africa, in fact, between 2003, 2004, 2005, Africa had a significant component. Now, you would see also that if you include the Middle East would have had about 24%, 26% and so on. Now, the reason why the figures are what they are is because this is, of course, the humanitarian intake. Now, the very nature of the humanitarian situation itself indicates that you look for those trouble spots in the world where, because of famine, because of wars, because of whatever the situation may be, people are displaced. And of course, we then make that gesture and make admissions. So, Africa features quite prominently on the basis that, of course, unfortunately, Africa perennially has had problems of war, famine, and so on and so forth. Somalia, Ethiopia, and so on. So, Australia, and to be fair, 2003, 2004, and so on, up to this point, actually gained a bigger intake to Africa. Once we hit here, you see that the figure begins to drop. This point here to this point. In fact, this was, of course, the post-Andrew scenario. Kevin Andrews decided we wouldn't be going too far. We'd be cutting down the number. But I'm interested in these figures because, well, it shows that, yes, there was an increase. Now, intake, particularly in the humanitarian intake, we were actually taking a lot more from Africa. Come to this point, we have reduced it, and in fact, if you look at the figures carefully, we try to make it almost spread equally anyway for all those countries involved. But to my mind, these figures don't tell us much anyway in the debate. I mean, what does it say about crime in any case? Take a look at these figures too. You see, in a way, we know that Australia was admitting a number of Africans from war-torn areas, but the figures I gave earlier wouldn't quite tell you who was coming in. This gives us a fairly brief idea. We have Sudan, these are the top 10 countries anyway. Now, of course, Iraq, with the war there, it makes a lot of sense. Myanmar, with its winter there,
creating troubles, as you can see the figures there too, and of course Afghanistan. Now, when you drop down, I'm not sure what's happening in Bhutan, but they are there too. When we drop down here, of course, most of the countries are actually in the African region. Now, anyone who knows a bit about international relations these days would, of course, understand what's going on in all these countries. Sudan with the problem in Darfur and the problem in the south and the north. Of course, Ethiopia with the Derek problems there and the Israel famine issues and so on. So we, all throughout here, of course, the Congo with the war there. Sierra Leone with the civil war. Liberia with the civil war. But even then, the figures are not exactly that dramatic anymore if you go to 2009. The reason being that if you add these three plus four figures together, actually what they give you much, much more in excess of what was coming from Africa in 2009. But still, that's not the issue. The issue is on these figures for me at all. The issue is, so, it's a fact. We have admitted more people from Africa. But when it comes to law and order, when it comes to crime as such, the question we ask is, so where do we stand? Have we seen an increase in crime because of this? That's what the issue really is. So let's take a look. Now, this is an interesting point. I came across this because we did some research on this area, and this point stuck in my head for quite a while. It was a teacher in Western Australia who made this statement that the African refugees are from war-torn countries, that they do not follow rules, they have no respect for Australian law. In fact, they have no respect for human life. That means nothing to them. They can be extremely vicious. An interesting point. It is true, of course, that a lot of these people are actually coming from war-torn countries. But to say that because you come from a war-torn country, that means nothing to you, well, that's obviously against you. Because that's not true. If that was the case, you wouldn't come here, you'd just stay there. To say that because you come from a war-torn country, you have no respect for human life, of course, doesn't make sense. Why else would we be, dealing with people from Afghanistan and so on, and Iraq? Nobody, in any case, has accused any Iraqi that because they come from a war-torn country, somehow they have no respect for life. It doesn't make sense. But that's not the issue yet. What's interesting to me, though, and what I must, of course, point out as part of this presentation is that the point has to be made that maybe, just maybe, that because there's a war in a particular area, if you are admitting people from that zone, now, if you profile those people you are admitting, particularly those in their 20s, males, is it quite possible that these are the gun-toting young boys who were once fighting in the jungles, whom you are bringing into your community? Isn't that possible, though? Sure. Is it quite possible that these are guerrilla fighters who somehow have grown tired of the fighting and have decided to come and live in the beauty of Australia? Isn't that possible? Now, you can't dismiss it altogether. The reason being that in some of the refugee camps, of course, when people have actually escaped the war, they may well actually take refuge in a camp and hope to settle somewhere. Who doesn't want to go to school anyway? Who wouldn't want the pleasure of a normal life elsewhere? So, my point is that it is actually feasible, it's quite possible, that some of the young boys would have actually fought before in Liberia. Some of the young boys would have fought before in Congo. Yes? And so they may well have eventually left to come here. Well, the same thing goes for Afghanistan in any case. The same thing goes for Iraq. But that's not the issue yet. Because the point you could then ask is that, granted that some kids from these countries may actually have seen quote-unquote action and are now back in Australia, has that created an environment where, to quote Geoff Collins, there should be moral panic? Let's look at the crime statistics. Now, in talking about the crime statistics, before we do so, one issue which, of course, everyone talk about in the media particularly has been a problem here, is that there is a great deal of anecdotal evidence. I don't want to go through them all, but if you talk to community members, if you talk to police officers, and of course if you listen to what the media has to say, we are never short of stories. We would hear about the rape, the gangs operating in the neighborhoods, and of course
the fact that some cars were hijacked in Melbourne in broad daylight by a gang of African youth. We, as a member of the African community, I of course know of instances in Auburn, Guildford, and Blacktown where kids have been involved in different types of crime too. I'm aware of that. But the question we ask is, so if we took a snapshot of the Australian criminal scene, what conclusions can we make? And can these conclusions, in fact, support the views expressed by Fraser, the views, in fact, expressed by Kevin Andrews, as the basis for his policy to reduce African migration intake? Now, these figures here have been compiled, and I've colored them just to make my point. This is, of course, from the Australian Institute of Criminology. Now, it's interesting to me because if you take a look at it, they give us a number of years, from 1996 to 2007. I've colored some parts green, just to make the point that, in actual fact, in some areas, incidents of crime actually reduced anyway. Even though we're taking more immigrants from Africa and so on. Of course, in some areas, particularly in assault, we see a trend, an upward trend. In here, we have instances of some fluctuation in sexual assault cases, but we also see an upward trend. If it comes to robberies, we do see a downward trend instead. Now, of course, kidnapping, we see an upward trend. The point I'm making is that this, of course, is the overall picture as given by the Institute. But please note this. These are victims of violent crimes, vicious crimes. Now, the reason I'm interested in the point about it being the victims of violent crimes report is that here we are looking at crime from the victim's perspective. These are police reports. These are community, if you like, interviews or survey reports and so on. Now, in terms of how much we can rely on them, it's an issue. The reason being that, as we just heard from two presentations ago, in actual fact, in talking about a proper and an objective assessment of particular profiles of who commits what crimes and so on, the best thing to do is to look at the prison census as such. The reason being that community reports in themselves will not really tell you much in terms of whether the person was actually convicted or not convicted. And without that, we can't really make any specific conclusions. But still, I thought it's nonetheless interesting to look at it from this perspective anyway. So let's go and look a bit more specifically at prison census. Now, this is an interesting point because I want us to look at these figures here. You'd see that if you begin from 1998, where, in fact, Ron just made the point, and Jock also emphasizes that, we have not really had good figures as such, reliable figures about some of these points. So, given what we have, we just start with the 1998 scenario anyway. Out here, you see that in 1998, we would have had about 84 people of African on background in our prison systems. However, by 2007, we had about 228. The number obviously is rising, but I would say that the number would have risen as a result of course, increases in the population in any case. Now, take a look then at what are situations which I'll bring up in a minute. But before I do so, the point I wish to make here is that, in a way, most of what people would say would be based on the anecdotal evidence in terms of what they've seen, what the papers have said. At this stage, the point I would make, of course, that anecdotal evidence would be of very little value to us. The reason why it would be of very little value is that surely, if we are interested in using any evidence as a basis for policy, as Kevin Andrews did, it can't be anecdotal. It's got to be proper empirical evidence as based on prison statistics or whatever it is that we may well have from official sources. He didn't do that. I'll just make a couple of points here before I just conclude my talk here. Now, for a start, the point we need to make is that the number of African male prisoners in Australia has, of course, increased with time. I'm using male prisoners, the reason being that the female prison population is negligible to be statistically of really no serious value. Now, on the statistics also, I would say, based on what the graph we just showed earlier, that there is, of course, a disproportionate number of
Somalians, Sudanese, and Nigerians in Australian prisons. And I'll bring up one more slide to show this in a minute. Finally, the point I would also stress before we go to my next slide is that African male prisoners comprise less than 1% of the total Australian prison population, even though we have actually seen increases in the number of Africans over the years. Now, this is an interesting graph for us because I just need to point out a couple of things. In here, we have Ghana, Sudan, Nigeria, and of course, we have Somalia and Egypt. Now, look at these points, this blue line here, which of course represents Egypt, and of course, the other blue represents South Africa. You see that these two lines are much higher. Of course, these are the Egyptians and South Africans tend to have the highest African population in the country. So not surprisingly, they tend to be much more heavily represented. But what's important to me is this. If you begin from this point here, 2004, we would have an incidence of an increase in the Somali population in terms of our prison numbers. That's quite important for our purposes. Now, you will also see that we have the Sudanese population also increasing a bit from this point onwards. That's quite critical also. Now, it's a problem which perhaps we need to talk about in terms of the time we have. I'm a bit concerned about it, but I'll just raise it now. The number of prisoners from Sudan has increased from 13, 23, it's increasing to 13, 23, and of course 36 over the years. In a way, the numbers are not that many. But what's important is that, you know, they were not there before. The numbers were quite negligible before, and it's going up. Now, the figure for Somalia, so like that, it's going up a bit. Now, in a way, if you compare to other countries in the system, theirs have been much slower, and so we've got to be careful with that. Now, this is not to say that because you're Sudanese or Somalian, it's an issue. But the point I'm making is that if one is interested in looking at the figures objectively, we need to take a good look at these figures. Now, finally, this is perhaps where we need to make a few other points. One could argue that it's not so important in terms of the numbers, but we have to compare it to the increases in the population size itself. So are we seeing more members going into the prison population as a particular population of that country increases? Now, here we would have two figures that may be of interest. There's this color here, of course, represents 2001. This color here represents 2006. The point we make is that if you look at 2006, 2001 and compare, for instance, if you take the case of Nigeria, in a way there's been a significant increase in terms of how the prison population has compared to the increase in the Nigerian population itself. The reason I'm saying it's quite important to take a look at it is that we compare that to the Australian increases. That's quite small. But more important for our purposes is that if you take a look at the Sudanese population increases here, at one time in 2001, we would have had zero zeros. But of course, come 2006, we see some appreciable increase. It's an important issue for us to look at. Now, what we then conclude is that, in a way, the issue isn't whether there's crime or not in the African community. No, because there is. The issue is whether taking up an increasing number of Africans has led to an increase in crime. The answer is no. But that's not perhaps the important matter for us to consider as members of the African community. What's important for us is that, what is it? That is the cause of crime within the community itself, anyway. And knowing what it is, what can we do to help fix it before it becomes an issue? The reason why I put it this way is that in some other discussions I've had with some African community members, I've actually jokingly said that, whatever the problem is, we need to deal with it now. You don't want to wait and then 10 years from now be confronted with a bunch of young boys unemployable and unemployed that you have to deal with. So whatever it is, let's find out what the problem is now and try and fix it. As someone has said, the major cause of crime is restlessness. And restlessness comes from community disadvantage. And these disadvantages are humorous. In fact, one can go through a lot. But the first dot point here needs to be stressed.
My point about the first world point is that, now, it's an issue where we admit people who come from a particular background.
If we actually have a humanitarian program which allows us to admit people from that background, then of course, we take into account the fact that their prior experience and issues that really made us actually admit them in the first place could be issues in any resettlement program. The failure to do so just lays the foundations for a failure of that particular group that we bring in. So, the Australian government itself has a lot of work to do here. And of course, we have a problem with inadequate supportive infrastructure. Actually, if you talk to any local government body out there, this is their major complaint. You can't settle people in the community, but what about the health facilities? What about the language facilities? And what about the other facilities that's supposed to help them settle in? My argument is that there's been a failure on the government's part. This failure, of course, would eventually translate into the failure of the community itself. In my dealings with several African communities, I usually come across one problem and make a joke of it. That, you know, here we are in Australia. You go to a nice African home, there's great African music, which is wonderful. There's great African food, which is unbeatable. Wonderful African stories, amazing. Great African clothing, excellent. Everything, great. So I say this, it all looks good, but everything you do here is just purely with an African attitude only. But you live in Australia, why did you bother coming here? You might as well have stayed back. In fact, there, it's even better. But the point I make here, and I make it with a degree of seriousness, is that it's natural for any ethnic group to associate with its own kind as much as possible. The only trouble is that it undermines your ability to network. It undermines your ability to communicate. It undermines your ability to settle. And this is perhaps the biggest issue facing the African community, because it actually affects communication. It presents a major communication barrier. And the communication barrier is accentuated, because in the case of people from Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia, where English isn't your background anyway, there's a major issue, because in a community such as Australia, of course, you need a language, English language, as a tool of communication. Without it, you stop. And that's what the situation is. And of course, the government does what it can in terms of schooling by taking kids in school for about 9 months to learn English before they continue. But hey, what's 9 months of English? What can it do for you? In most instances, teachers complain that these kids in schools can't cope. And if they can't cope, usually they become restless. And of course, out of this restlessness, what we have are kids who become, to quote the usual word, part of gangs. I've been asked to cut my throat, which means maybe I should stop soon, because he's here telling me to do it. So I thought it was a nice sign to cut my throat, so I'm going to stop. Well, thanks very much. I would just reserve for the rest of what I have to say for questions and answers.